everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Normally, we would have a group on to discuss one single issue, an important issue to all of us, from a progressive point of view. However, I'm on the road and decided instead, when looking at all the notes I have on so many different issues, that I would not have a guest on today. Instead, I would take on many of these issues, giving you perspective, and then in the second part of our program, opening up our talkback lines so you can call in and share your points of view. I won't be taking calls for at least 30 minutes. I have a lot of topics to deal with. Our call-in number, 888-874-4888. Now, we're going to talk about Big Pharma's profiteering off very expensive medications, Martha Rosenberg. Four things that are happening today that indicate that a deflationary financial collapse is imminent, Michael Snyder. Why would 46 senators support burning trees for electricity when it contributes more to climate change than coal? Lucas Ross, Friends of the Earth. Finland is the poster child for why the euro doesn't work, Matt O'Brien, The Washington Post. Emerging market currencies crash on Fed fears and China's slump. We'll discuss that. Ambrose Evan Pritchard, The Telegraph. The U.S. managed to make Afghanistan the world's top heroin exporter. Well, hold on. Don't we have a war on drugs? Yes. So you mean we are facilitating the largest manufacturing, growing, importing of drugs in the world? Yeah. Well, that does make a lot of sense. So we'll explore with Jack Balkhill from Counterpunch. Gold derivatives are at $1.5 quadrillion. That's a time bomb. Stephen Ledman. Also, confidential documents, the Red Cross itself may not know how millions donated for Hawaii were spent, and the scandal is really major. A retired U.S. general admits military's role in creating ISIS, by Kerry Welder, Anti-Media. Obama blocks investigators' access to files related to the Department of Justice scandals, by a lawyer, Joe Wolverton. Whistleblower exposes torture and child abuse at for-profit prisons, Sarah Lazar. Plus, from our audio clips, we will talk with a victim of Gardasil speaking out, Brittany. Also, from America's favorite Christian, Betty Bowers, Goodwill to Few Men, and How the CIA Kills Countries, John Perkins. We've had him on this program. He's going to talk about how behind the scenes the United States government changes regimes to suit the needs of our ideology and, most importantly, our corporate partners. So what's good for a particular grower of bananas in Honduras, well, that's good for America. So in comes the jackals to assassinate, but before them, there are the economic hitmen, including John Perkins, who go in to say, here's the deal, buddy. You have to do this for us and private corporations, or you will die. Hard to believe? Wait to hear what he has to say. So as you see, we have a lot to cover, and let's begin. First up, I think anyone who read over the internet about a man who was bitten by a rattlesnake, it ended up costing him $158,000. How is that possible? Well, it's what they charge you in a hospital for everything, including the drugs. And you think, well, that's absurd. Compared to what? Compared to a pharmaceutical drug, a chemotherapy that runs $30,000 for a single injection, and you're going to have to be injected every month for a year or two, that's a lot of money. Who makes that money? Why isn't there an outrage, a protest? How many hands are getting a part of that money on them? It's no secret that the pill profit party is over for drug companies. Best-selling pills like Lipitor, Seroquel, Zyprexa, Singulair, Concerta, Ambify, have gone off patent, and Wall Street is moving on to industries that offer better returns. To combat investor disenchantment, drug companies have rolled out expensive drugs that treat such rare conditions. They almost sound like satire. If you're sleepy during the day, you may have narcolepsy, says Jazz Pharmaceutical Company, which has a drug that treats for $35,000 a year. And if you have frequent diarrhea, gas, or bloating, you may have endocrine pancreatitis insufficiency, so says another drug company, and they'll sell you a drug called Creon. Drug makers are even not above scaring the population if it sells drugs for rare disease. Your back pain may not be due from working out or from bending over and pulling a muscle, may do they call to an ankylosing spondylosis, and they have just the drug for you. Oh, and it costs you $20,000 a year. The drug industry is also trying to stay a Wall Street darling with new Uber-priced drugs, notably hepatitis C drugs. Gilead Sciences sold $12 billion worth of a single drug. How much does that drug cost you for hepatitis? $1,000 a pill. And that's according to the New York Times. While drug company representatives initially tried to cast the outrageous prices as recouping their research and development costs, they quickly backpedaled into admitting the drugs are priced on value, what they are worth for the patient's health. Needless to say, such valuations come pretty close to the definition of extortion. Every business out there is interested in making a profit. But when you have a drug for hepatitis that runs the average person $84,000 a year, and yet, if you went to Egypt, you would pay $900 a year for the same exact drug. $900 in Egypt, $84,000 in the United States. What's the difference? Well, in the United States, taxpayers, you and I, pick up the bill through Medicaid, the VA, and the prison systems. Now, Senefi and Regeneron Pharmaceuticals are rolling out a cholesterol-lowering drug which could be embraced by millions, who made the statin Lipitor the best-selling drug in the world before it went off patent. And yet the price of their injectable drug is over $14,000. And that's not even getting into the chemotherapy drugs. So here's the takeaway message. If you have cancer today and you're put on a chemotherapy drug, there's absolutely no proof that they have long-term double-blind, placebo-controlled studies showing that that drug will extend the quality of your life measurably or keep you from dying. There is no science. The science is so flawed, so fraudulent, so misleading that people assume that when their doctor says, well, this is the drug you must take, you may see a study that allows you to live an extra 4 days or 5 days and not in good condition. It's about the money. Why? Because in the field of oncology, unlike neurology, cardiology, gastroenterology, in cancer field, the oncologist is allowed to actually sell the drug. So let's say, hypothetically, that a drug costs a doctor $6,000 per treatment. He then charges, or she, the patient $12,000. Well, that's $6,000 net profit for the doctor. I can promise you there's not one patient that's going to know that the doctor was selling him a drug. Now, let's say that you have 100 patients. Well, you just made $600,000. Now, let's say you have 100 patients a month. Well, then you've made over almost $7 million for the year. And that's just on the price of the drug. It has nothing to do with the cost to the patient for the actual medical treatment. And yet there seems to be no one interested. And that's why medicine today is a $3.5 trillion industry. It provides some of the worst health care in the world. We have some of the worst statistics in the world. Yet if you wanted to lower your risk of diabetes, you could exercise de-stress, take supplements, and eat right. Eat low-glycemic, quality, plant-based foods. We've seen so many people go from being a diabetic on medications and overweight and putting their life at risk to completely normal and healthy. No meds. The same is true for cholesterol. They won't tell you that diet and exercise can do a great deal to lower cholesterol or blood pressure. They keep giving you that there's only one approach to disease, their way. And of course, they're all in collusion. The foundations, the think tanks, the pharmaceutical companies, the medical magazines that get the ads, the television programs that get the ads also, and all the perks that the physicians get and the high prices. So where is there an advocate for the consumer? Well, there are none. So caveat emptor, consumer beware. Also, here we have a contradiction. I do not believe that we should have a war on drugs. It has about as much logic to it as prohibition. What came from prohibition? Well, there was a group of people living on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Several were immigrants from Italy. They were kids, but they started to see how they could profit by selling drugs, and they got into the business, and then the rackets. And then when prohibition came along in the early 1920s, they were in the perfect place to take advantage of this. And this group became the first organized crime in the United States. There were a couple people that headed it before. One man, Lucky Luciano, this is a Sicilian mobster, took it over, and he had a group with him. Frank Costello, who would be his right-hand man, Bugsy Siegel, Meyer Lansky, and Vito Genovese. Now, Genovese would survive all these people, as would Meyer Lansky. Bugsy Siegel was not so lucky. But for about 25 years, this group of people, until Bugsy Siegel in 1947 was killed, they controlled virtually all the major crime in the United States. And they made their money. They got into the business based upon prohibition. There were thousands of speakeasies, places where you could go and drink all you wanted. So by having a prohibition against alcohol, we created La Cosa Nostra, organized crime, and without all the other illicit activities they could do because they had a strong foundation. Oh, and by the way, unlike the movie The Godfather that depicted a scene where they decided to get into the drug business, that was myth. Organized crime had been in the drug business of selling heroin since the early part of the 1900s, but it really was in full force by the 1920s. Now, so you would think that we would learn something. We didn't. So we had a war on drugs. The very drugs at one time were legal, safe, and were in cold medications, Coca-Cola, that was drugs, and a lot of doctors gave the happy pill, and that was morphine. And also later, it would be heroin. So now we have a war on drugs. In Mexico alone, 70,000 killed, 100,000 disappeared, assumed that they're also dead in the last 5 to 6 years. And organized crime all over the world, profiting from people's desire for drugs for whatever reason, and our society's inability to say, well, why are people wanting a drug to begin with? What could be wrong in their life that they would want this drug, knowing, as most people do, there's a side effect? Cocaine, methamphetamine, crack. Yeah, you get a little high. It removes you from the day-to-day reality and stresses, but it really upends your life, and those are the people that care about you. But we won't even have that conversation because that conversation could look at our lives and what's missing. And maybe our overemphasis upon thinking that happiness is something we can buy. The right person, the right car, the right apartment, the right anything. Well, none of that buys you happiness. And yet look how we strive for it. So just imagine all the ways that we have created such a highly stressed society that the individual gets lost, their own personal identity gets lost. So then people would drink, other people do drugs, a whole generation did marijuana, and where I'm completely in support of legalizing all drugs and decriminalizing them and let everyone that's in jail out of jail because of drug use, I also believe that we have to be honest and face the facts that drugs hurt the body. Marijuana, in specific, I have known people that it has caused paranoid delusions, and one that became permanently disabled because of it, and psychotic. So there are downsides, though people generally in use deny these. And so why don't we have treatment centers in the United States, in every community, every single one, where you're not judged? This is not a part of a permanent federal record. Rather, you can go into a place because you have a psychological, behavioral need that is not being addressed. Instead of relying upon the drugs or having relied upon the drugs, you at least have a safe and humanistic environment to be detoxified and help psychologically so you can gain a sense of emotional and introspective strength and re-enter society. We shouldn't allow people to re-enter society as ex-cons, frequently no right to vote, not having any credit, and being unemployable except the most menial tasks, destroying the extended family that these people have. That shows what we're missing at a societal level and certainly at a policymaking level. And it's rather ironic that the last three presidents have all been dope users. And it's a matter of fact. It's not conjecture. Well, if they're that concerned, as Bill Clinton was and George Bush and Barack Obama, why don't they spend 1 week in the same prison that they're putting millions of people, millions have gone through because of this, and see if it changes their perception? Big difference being an emperor and treated like a god and believing you are one, as the sociopathic political class, wealthy class, billionaire class, the oligarchs do, where you feel that you're in contempt of anyone that is stupid enough to commit a crime, and yet these are the biggest criminals of all time, corporate America. So then imagine, as Jack Balkwill says, that it should come as no surprise that an Afghan general was caught smuggling heroin. Ah, the surprise is that any high official in that country should be charged with a crime for profiting from the trade in illegal drugs while under the watchful eye of American forces. Now, under American occupation, Afghanistan quickly became the world's leader in opium production, producing over 90% of the world's supply. The Taliban had almost shut down opium production prior to the U.S. invasion in 2001 to the concern of the international drug runners. And no doubt the international banking industry, which earns big profits, laundering billions of dollars in illegal drug money annually. And if you doubt that, look at the major court case that was settled last year where one bank, one single bank, was shown to have laundered $800 billion in illegal drug money over the last decade or so, and they only had to pay a $900 million fine, and they got to keep their ill-gotten gains. So, let's just do the math. You earn $800 billion illegally. You pay $900 million fine. You're not even paying a 1%, so you get to keep 99%. Crime pays. And yet those people's reputations was not at all adversely affected. The United States government, whole other agencies of government will do business with those same people, the same as the people found guilty of Wall Street fraud and fixing the LIBOR interest rate and fixing the commodities prices of gold and silver and other commodities last 2 weeks ago and spend $1 billion. $1 billion is not even chump change in the commodities market. So here we have a war on drugs, and yet we, the United States, as official policy, is making sure that those drugs get to market. Illegal drugs account for about 8% of all international trade. That's huge. Few Americans are aware of the long history of the CIA running illegal drugs internationally, thanks to the untiring efforts of the mainstream press. Were citizens aware, few would be surprised that heroin production has skyrocketed under U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. The tragic case of journalist Gary Webb, of the San Jose Mercury News is a case in point and represents perhaps the widest known attempt at suppressing the story of CIA drug running endeavors, with the mainstream U.S. press shamelessly, especially the New York Times, but they have no shame. They're utterly contemptible. I think it is a disservice to humanity to work at the New York Times. That's my personal opinion. But when I was talking with Gary Webb, something the New York Times chose not to do, and we spent hours and hours going over his research, and one night we were at Columbia University and at the School of Journalism, and he was receiving an award from Project Censored in the very first year. And my publisher, Dan Simon of Seven Stories Press, was presenting the award because he had published Gary Webb's the book, Censored, Project Censored, that Gary Webb's article appeared in. And I said, Gary, you know you're going up against people that have no morals. They will kill you. And he just shrugged his shoulders and he said, I'm fully aware of that. He said, I know what I'm up against, but I also know I would rather be up against them than my own conscience of knowing the truth and not reporting it. That was a personal conversation Gary and I had. We had many. And all the while, I then watched all the major media attack him. Attack him without the opportunity to sit and look at his research, look at his facts, follow the trail he opened, and they chose not to. The truth, in the 1980s, the CIA was actively, directly shipping cocaine from Central America into the USA using its own airline in order to earn money to circumvent a congressional ban on continued support for the terrorist Contras, a Reagan administration-backed counterinsurgency seeking to overthrow democracy in Nicaragua on behalf of the U.S. ruling interest. Webb lost his job, was blackballed from his profession for telling the truth, and eventually, some say, committed suicide. I don't believe that. I believe the evidence is compelling that he was murdered. And in any case, he was gone, and our corrupt system then shut one whistleblower down. Former Drug Enforcement Administrator Officer Michael Levine wrote that he discovered heroin was being smuggled into the USA inside the bodies of U.S. troops who had died in Vietnam during the 60s. And after reporting this ghoulish information, he was transferred and told that it was a CIA operation and he should shut up. Don't talk about it. And after being transferred to South America, Levine then reported on massive cocaine smuggling and again was told, shut your mouth, because it too was a CIA operation and he should go along with the program. Well, like Gary Webb, Levine was a person of character and ethics. He eventually realized that much international drug smuggling into the United States was under the direct control of the CIA, and he resigned from the CIA, or he resigned from the DEA. Levine states without hesitation, the CIA has long been a major supporter of the people and organizations responsible for supplying drugs to this country. Time and time again, quote, I discovered that various people against whom we were trying to build a case were regarded as assets by the CIA. Of course, at the time, those assets were described as allies in the Cold War by my DEA sources tell me that this remains the case even now that the Cold War was over, end quote. The U.S. government pretends to care about eradicating opium production in Afghanistan while production soars to record levels. Why? Well, the largest marketplace for illegal drugs continues to be the United States, despite a decades-long so-called war on drugs. Is that an accident? And can it be an accident between 2002 and 2013, the 11 years that the U.S. has been occupying and fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan, that it became the number one supplier of heroin in the world? Recall that when the government wanted to stop the recent anti-banker democracy movement known as Occupy Wall Street, it did so in a matter of months, showing clearly where its priorities and capabilities lie. As was exposed in This Can't Be Happening, the Obama administration coordinated efforts nationally with individual cities where tear gas, beatings, pepper spray, jailing, and other tactics were used to deny the right of the people to peacefully assemble. They were treated no differently in the United States than the young people and old people that went to the square in Egypt and risked their lives to say no more corruption, no more dictatorship. Well, there was a bizarre plot in Houston to have leaders of the small Occupy movement there murdered using, quote, suppressed rifle fire, a plot the new FBI knew about but did nothing to prevent. Apparently that plan, whose conspirators were never identified publicly, was called off because Occupy famously had no leaders who could be targeted. So if they shot four people, there'd be four more people to take their place. That the U.S. government cannot similarly crack down successfully on the annual importation of billions of dollars worth of illegal drugs should cause anyone, not comatose, to at least question the system. Our motto should be, leave no bangster behind. We know they do buy our politicians, with President Obama having received a record amount of campaign funding in 2008 from the banking industry shortly before he pushed through the massive bailout on their behalf. As long as international banking makes billions of dollars from the illegal narcotics trade, we can expect the war on drugs to be as much of a fraud as the profitable war on terrorism, whose contractors also supply those who run our government with massive campaign financing, ensuring we will not soon run out of either cartels to distribute drugs illegally or people that we can say are terrorists and justify bankrupting America in the pursuit thereof. So what is the answer? The answer is simple. Legalize all drugs, set up treatment centers to help those people who are in addiction mode, and then have an extensive educational program on what can be done if you feel like doing a drug, what else could you do, and what are the likely outcomes. Now, it won't prevent all people from doing drugs, but it will certainly make a difference. After all, think how many people today are not smoking because of the effort to educate people about the dangers. I'm sure you've all seen, if you watch any television, the program of this person who's just weeks away from dying, and they have had their throat box removed, and it shows them saying, you know, how foolish they were, but they made the mistake, and then a little caption says they died shortly after. You can't see something like that without feeling enormous empathy for that person. But think of all the people every day who are looking to hide from the reality of the pain they feel in their own lives. Insecurity is a big motivator to escape it. And we should be dealing with that, not putting people in prison. I'm Gary Knoll, and today's a little different program because we're dealing with a lot of different issues, and I'd like your input in a moment. And by the way, talking about our economy, it is my belief, as well as Gerald Celente, Michael Hudson, and others, that we're in for not a recession, but a major depression. Now, that may seem strange, considering how powerful the dollar is right now, because other people are running from their currencies into the dollar, because it's a safe haven. But that's a fool's errand, because the dollar in the United States, so many have been printed that we're not accepting what should be the cycle of reducing the value of the dollar because of just printing trillions and trillions of dollars, over 16 trillion additional dollars. And we have nothing backing it up, nothing. We've gone off the gold standard. So in effect, the United States has officially about $120 trillion in debts. What that does not include are unfunded or partially funded entitlements that will be due and that you must add into that if you're going to be honest, which takes that amount up to at least $160 trillion. Now, when you consider that we do about $15 trillion a year in the gross domestic product, then the debt to our asset income is huge, absolutely huge. In fact, we're the worst of any country in the world, as far as any developed country in the world, We think Greece is a basket case, about 160% debt to asset, but Japan has 210% debt. It's bankrupt. It could never pay off its bills. And so Spain and Italy, they're up there around 100%. So these countries aren't able to pay their debt and squeezing people, making them go through austerity measures, cutting back their pensions, firing people, selling off to private corporations and privatizing public assets. So now people have to pay for water or traveling down a road. It's unfair and it's not reasonable. And we are saying we are the country that is the best to invest in. Based upon what? An artificial bubble equities market that will even get higher? So just understand, we're going to get slammed. Real estate is going to plummet in most places. And the value of the dollar is just going to drop like a lead balloon within probably the next 24 months. Here's what Michael Snyder says. Four things that are happening today that indicate that a deflationary financial collapse is imminent. One, commodities are crashing. In mid-2008, just before the U.S. stock market crashed in the fall, commodities started crashing hard. Well, now it's happening again. In fact, Bloomberg Commodity Index just hit a 13-year low, which means that it is already lower than it was at any point during the last fiscal crisis. Two, oil is crashing. On Monday, the price of oil dipped below $50 a barrel. This has surprised many analysts because a lot of them thought that the price of oil would start to rebound by now. In early 2014, the price of a barrel of oil was hitting $100 a barrel, and the future of the industry looked very bright. Since that time, the price of oil has fallen by more than 50%. There is only one other time in all of history when the price of oil has fallen by more than $50 a barrel in such a short period of time. That was in 2008, just before the great financial crisis that erupted later that year. And as anyone can see who looks at the truth of it, the last oil crash was in 2008, and we're now experiencing something similar. Also, gold is crashing. Most people don't remember that the price of gold took a very serious tumble in the run-up to the financial crisis, 2008. In early 2008, the price of gold almost reached 1,000 an ounce, but by October, it had fallen to 700 an ounce. And of course, the stock market finally crashed. It only propelled gold to unprecedented heights, and it went up to about $1,800. My view is it should be about $3,000 at this point. So it's now falling again. And the U.S. dollar index is surging. Now, that might be a little confusing to people because the U.S. stock market crashed in the fall of 2008. The U.S. dollar went on a very impressive run. This is something that you can see if you look at statistics. Now, the U.S. dollar is experiencing similar rise. For a while there, it looked like the rally might fizzle out, but in recent days, the dollar has started to skyrocket once again. That may sound like good news to most Americans, but the truth is that a strong dollar is highly deflationary for the global financial system as a whole for a variety of reasons. So those are some things that, just to let you know, things are happening around the whole area of financing, and people are not paying attention to it. Let me give you another part of that puzzle. This is from The Telegraph and Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who is always accurate. Here's an article, Emerging Market Currencies Crash on Fed Fears and China Slump. Quote, the currencies of Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, and Turkey have all crashed to multi-year lows as investors flee emerging markets and commodity prices crumble. The drastic moves came as fears of imminent monetary tightening by the U.S. Federal Reserve, combined with shockingly weak figures from China, which stokes fears that the country may be sliding into a deeper downturn and send tremors through East Asia, Latin America, and Africa. In fact, China has fell to a 15-month low, and they've lost about $3.5 trillion. Now, these are not big corporations. These are small people. Why did they lose that amount of money? Because for the last 5 years, China has been one huge bubble. They were building cities that no one lived in because developers had massive amounts of money and went on building sprees and selling the apartments that no one would ever live in because they felt, well, if I buy this apartment at $200,000, in 5 years from now, it'll be worth $500,000. And so millions upon millions of Chinese have put every penny they had into commodities and futures and in real estate. Well, it's all crashing. And so when that kind of crash happens, people then want to get into a place where they feel safer, so they're rushing into the dollar. No one's paying attention to how much debt do we have. The United States has so much debt, it can never pay it back. But nobody can take anything from us either. So we're in one of those unique positions of being the biggest, brawniest, steroid-driven person in the bar who kept saying, fill them up, everyone, it's on me, and then walks out without paying. Who's going to come and tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, why should you have a different standard than the rest of us are held accountable? So the U.S. is bankrupt, totally, completely bankrupt. And that is the truth of it. There are industries that prosper. There are people who are wealthy. But you go around and talk with 250 million Americans, and they are suffering. 18 million children are hungry. 15 million senior citizens can't manage. Suicide is going through the roof for older people. And people have jobs working two or three at a time for minimal wage. And yet all that seems to be of no consequence. It is a consequence. And by the way, one last thing, and the most dangerous thing economically I can think of, and that is a piece from Stephen Ledman, a very wise man. Quote, when investing becomes gambling, bad endings follow. The next credit crunch will make 2008-09 look mild by comparison. Bank of International Settlements data show about $700 trillion in global derivatives. Along with credit default swaps and other exotic instruments, the total notional derivatives value is $1.5 quadrillion, about 20% more than 2008, beyond what anyone can conceive, let alone control, if unexpected turmoil strikes. The late Bob Chapman predicted it. So does Paul Craig Roberts. It could destroy Western civilization, he believes. Financial deregulation turned Wall Street into a casino with no rules except unrestrained making money. Catastrophic failure awaits. It's just a matter of time. Ellen Brown calls the derivatives casino a last-ditch attempt to prop up a private pyramid scheme, slowly crumbling under its own weight. For years, Warren Buffett called derivatives financial time bombs for economics and the ordinary person. Unless collateralized or guaranteed, their worth depends upon the creditworthiness of the counterparties. Earnings on derivatives are widely overstated, Buffett explains, because they are based on estimates whose inaccuracies may not be exposed for many years. When corporate bosses ask financial executives how profits look in any quarter, they in turn ask how much do you want, then manipulate them to oblige when told. So civilization's only hope is smashing them, dismantling them into small, impotent pieces, or ideally, putting money back into public hands where it belongs. It's too important to be privately controlled. Financial predators entrap small, weak nations into unpayable debt peonage like Greece, bleed them dry, and third worldize developed ones into dystopian backwaters. And while they grow rich and powerful, they are all corrupt, and in time, it'll all go bust, decimating billions worldwide in greater human misery than already. I'm Gary Noll. Your turn. Talk back now, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And while we're waiting for your calls to come in, let's hear from, we'll go to Gardasil and hear what one of the people named Brittany has to say about her experience with Gardasil.
Hi, my name is Brittany Feist, and in 2007, I was scared into taking the Gardasil shot. In June, I had my first shot right after my 21st birthday, and in August 24th, 2007, I had my second shot. After the second shot, I became very, very ill. With the first one, I was starting to get some signs, but we didn't put it together with what was happening with me. And when I took the second one, it was official. I had had an adverse reaction. I lost the ability to walk. I started falling down. I needed help. I had head pressure that would press from my skull down to my jaw and into my neck and my back. And I would end up talking with like a ventriloquist because I could not move my jaw. My back and my neck would swell very large, and it felt like a baggie of water was on my neck and my back, on the back of my neck. I had seizures for a year and a half. I also have had problems with a rash. I still have the rash. I don't have the seizures anymore, but I do still struggle. I have trouble with my vision. Right now I'd be wearing sunglasses if I could, but I can't because you need to see my face and all my facial expressions. This is very hard to talk about. It's pretty much taken 2 years of my life away. I'm going to be 23 next week. And I feel like all my hopes and dreams have been ripped from me. I can't go to school. I can't be normal. I can't go out with friends. I can't have a good time. I can't handle noise. I can't handle conversations. This vaccine has to be taken off the market. It's stealing too many lives. And people need to see the truth, and it needs to not be covered up by any pharmaceutical company. Very painful to deal with when you can't feel your legs. And the doctors say I'm going to get better, and they're working with me, and I'm taking supplements and vitamins and all these different things, but they say it's going to take a very long time to recover. This is not what I wanted at the age of 23 for a life. I did not want to be stuck at home, feeling trapped around four walls in different rooms. We're stuck on one level of my house. I wanted to be out driving. I wanted to be in school. I wanted to have a degree and a life. So if this helps, which I hope it does, people need to stop taking things from commercials and saying, oh, that sounds great, and start doing research, because someone else could get hurt just like me, or worse, and too many people have died already. Oh, I know what to say. I don't know what to say anymore.
And that is Brittany. And by the way, in doing the three different documentaries, and I'm now doing a fourth, there are over 1 million Brittanys, children, young people who've been damaged by vaccines, and an entire media that refuses to be responsible and look for the truth. And that's unfortunate, especially for people who want to have healthy children would want a choice in vaccination, and now because of state laws that will be passed in every state, starting with California, they won't have that opportunity. So we're going to see millions upon millions of children damaged just like her. Now let's go over and hear from an economic hitman about the power of the CIA and how we really do business in other countries, especially when someone is not acting the way we want them to.
The precedent for economic hitmen really began back in the early 50s when democratically elected Mossadegh was elected in Iran. He was considered to be the hope for democracy in the Middle East and around the world. He was Time Magazine's Man of the Year. But one of the things that he'd run on and began to implement was the idea that foreign oil companies needed to pay the Iranian people a lot more for the oil that they were taking out of Iran. The Iranian people should benefit from their own oil. Strange policy. We didn't like that, of course. But we were afraid to do what we normally were doing, which was to send in the military. Instead, we sent in one CIA agent, Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's relative. And Kermit went in with a few million dollars and was very, very effective and efficient. And in a short amount of time, he managed to get Mossadegh overthrown and brought in the Shah of Iran to replace him, who always was favorable to oil. And it was extremely effective.
Mobs overflow Tehran. Army officers shout that Mossadegh has surrendered and his regime as virtual dictator of Iran is ended. Pictures of the Shah are paraded through the streets as sentiment reverses. The Shah is welcomed home.
So back here in the United States, in Washington, people looked around and said, wow, that was easy and cheap. So this established a whole new way of manipulating countries, of creating empire. The only problem with Roosevelt was that he was a card-carrying CIA agent, and had he been caught, the ramifications could have been pretty serious. So very quickly at that point, the decision was made to use private consultants to channel the money through the World Bank or the IMF or one of the other such agencies, to bring in people like me who worked for private companies, so that if we got caught, there would be no governmental ramifications. When Arbenz became president of Guatemala, the country was very much under the thumbs of United Fruit Company, the big international corporations. And Arbenz ran on this ticket that says, you know, we want to get the land back to the people. And once he took power, he was implementing policies that would do exactly that, give land rights back to the people. United Fruit didn't like that very much. And so they hired a public relations firm, launched a huge campaign in the United States to convince the United States, the people, the citizens of the United States, and the press of the United States, and the Congress of the United States, that Arbenz was a Soviet puppet, and that if we allowed him to stay in power, the Soviets would have a foothold in this hemisphere. And that, at that point in time, was a huge fear on everybody's mind, the Red Terror, the Communist Terror. And so, to make a long story short, out of this public relations campaign came a commitment on the part of the CIA and the military to take this man out. And in fact, we did. We sent in planes, we sent in soldiers, we sent in jackals, we sent everything in to take him out, and did take him out. And as soon as he was removed from office, the new guy that took over after him basically reinstated everything to the big international corporations, including United Fruit. Ecuador, for many, many years, had been ruled by pro-U.S. dictators, often relatively brutal. Then it was decided that they were going to have a truly democratic election. Jaime Roldós ran for office, and his main goal, he said, as president, would be to make sure that Ecuador's resources were used to help the people. And he won, overwhelming, by more votes than anybody had ever won anything in Ecuador. And he began to implement these policies to make sure that the profits from oil went to help the people. Well, we didn't like that in the United States. I was sent down as one of several economic hitmen to change Roldós, to corrupt him, to bring him around, to let him know, you know, okay, you know, you can get very rich, you and your family, if you play our game, but if you continue to try to keep these policies you've promised, you're going to go. He wouldn't listen. He was assassinated. As soon as the plane crashed, the whole area was cordoned off. The only people allowed in were U.S. military from a nearby base and some of the Ecuadorian military. When an investigation was launched, two of the key witnesses died in car accidents before they had a chance to testify. A lot of very, very strange things that went on around the assassination of Jaime Roldós. I, like most people who've really looked at this case, have absolutely no doubt that it was an assassination. And of course, in my position as an economic hitman, I was always expecting something to happen to Jaime, whether it be a coup or assassination, I wasn't sure, but that he would be taken down because he was not being corrupted. He would not allow himself to be corrupted the way we wanted to corrupt him. Omar Torrijos, president of Panama, was, you know, one of my favorite people. I really, really liked him. He was very charismatic. He was a guy who really wanted to help his country. And when I tried to bribe him or corrupt him, he said, look, John, he called me Juanito. He said, look, Juanito, I don't need the money. What I really need is for my country to be treated fairly. I need for the United States to repay the debts that you owe my people for all the destruction you've done here. I need to be in a position where I can help other Latin American countries win their independence and be free of this terrible presence from the north that you people are exploiting us so badly. I need to have the Panama Canal back in the hands of the Panamanian people. That's what I want. And so leave me alone. Don't try to bribe me. It was 1981, and in May, Jaime Roldós was assassinated. And Omar was very aware of this. Torrijos got his family together and he said, I'm probably next, but it's okay because I've done what I came here to do. I've renegotiated the canal. The canal will now be in our hands. He just finished negotiating the treaty with Jimmy Carter. In June of that same year, just a couple of months later, he also went down in an airplane crash, which there's no question was executed by CIA-sponsored jackals. Tremendous amount of evidence that one of Torrijos' security guards handed him at the last moment as he was getting on the plane, a tape recorder, a small tape recorder, that contained a bomb. It is interesting to me how this system has continued pretty much the same way for years and years and years, except the economic hitmen have got better and better and better. Then we come up with, very recently, what happened in Venezuela. In 1998, Hugo Chavez gets elected president, following a long line of presidents who had been very corrupt and basically destroyed the economy of the country. And Chavez was elected amidst all that. Chavez stood up to the United States, and he's done it primarily demanding that Venezuelan oil be used to help the Venezuelan people. Well, we didn't like that in the United States. So in 2002, a coup was staged, which there's no question in my mind, of most other people's minds, that the CIA was behind that coup. The way that that coup was fomented was very reflective of what Kermit Roosevelt had done in Iran, of paying people to go out into the streets to riot, to protest, to say this Chavez is very unpopular. You know, if you can get a few thousand people to do that, in television, and can make it look like it's the whole country, and things start to mushroom. Except in the case of Chavez, he was smart enough, and the people were so strongly behind him that they overcame it, which was a phenomenal moment in the history of Latin America. Iraq actually is a perfect example of the way the whole system works. So we economic hitmen are the first line of defense. We go in and we try to corrupt governments and get them to accept these huge loans, which we then use as leverage to basically own them. If we fail, as I failed in Panama with Omar Torrijos and in Ecuador with Jaime Roldós, men who refused to be corrupted, then the second line of defense is we send in the jackals. And the jackals either overthrow governments or they assassinate. And once that happens and a new government comes in, boy, it's going to toe the line because the new president knows what will happen if he doesn't. In the case of Iraq, both of those things failed. economic hitmen were not able to get through to Saddam Hussein. We tried very hard. We tried to get him to accept a deal very similar to what the House of Saud had accepted in Saudi Arabia, but he wouldn't accept it. And so the jackals went in to take him out. They couldn't do it. His security was very good. After all, he had one time worked for the CIA. He'd been hired to assassinate a former president.
And that's John Perkins and How We Really Do Business. I'm Gary Knoll. We're out of time for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on the next program. Have a nice day, everyone.